Hi, yes, I am the aforementioned Norm Pattis, and there's Erica Farber. I tried to hire Erica 1,000 times many years ago, and she had the good sense not to come over. But your career has been an inspiration to me, my dear, and always will be. So, thank you. We've got a great panel here. We really do have a great panel, and I think you're going to find a lot of interesting discussion from a lot of different points of view. We've got to my immediate left, we have Dan Granger. Dan is CEO and the founder of a major advertising company, Oxford Road, that was an early adopter of podcasting and still very much involved in podcasting, and will give us a point of view that I think we will that will be somewhat different than we might get from our esteemed publishers and producers here and chief content officers. And since I mentioned a chief content officer, let me introduce you to Andy Bowers, who is the chief content officer of Panoply, who's been involved with all of the Slate podcasts, really the driving force behind Slate podcasts for many, many years. If you've been to any of these in the past, this guy is not a mystery to you. We've been on panels together. It's always been good, and I think it's been informative. The guy next to him is bigger than life. I met Tom Likas in every way. I met Tom Likas a couple of decades ago when he was one of the most talented guys on radio. I mean, he reinvented himself two or three times during the times that I knew you. And a wonderful and gifted and talented talk radio personality who has moved into podcasting and moved into it very, very effectively. I don't know, what, 3 years ago, something like that? And, yeah, there's only one live mic here. I wanted it that way. Okay. I assume somebody will make those mics hot. And we'll hear the story of that as we move along. And our final panel member is a young man named Rob Sisterino, who has a podcast called Rob Has a Podcast. And it is hugely popular. And I know Rob quite well because he's on the Podcast One platform, and we have really enjoyed working together. He's got a really, really interesting story about how we got into podcasting and how it's turned into a very, very, I think, successful, not avocation anymore. It's a business for you, right?
Yeah,
it is a business, and it's something that I spend pretty much... Yeah, we need some mics here. Is there something to switch on down at the bottom, or that's hot?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm a full-time podcaster at this point and have been for the last year and a half, and it's a very exciting thing to be working in.
Well, let me start it with this. We talked a little bit about how we wanted to kick this thing off. And I did an interview recently for a trade magazine. I don't remember which one it was, but they said, "Is this the real golden age of podcasting?" And I said, "Well, it depends how you define it. I mean, in terms of content, there's great content out there. It's getting better and better, and there's more of it, and it's getting more and more attention. So we could be sort of on a pathway to the golden age." You know, my definition of a golden age is a lot bigger than where we are right now. But in terms of the financial nature of the podcasting business, how we fund ourselves, whether it's through subscriptions or advertisers or combinations of both, you know, which would include product marketing, merchandising, all kinds of things, I said, we're still just a teeny, teeny, tiny little business. But I think the rate at which it's growing could put us on the pathway to see a golden age and be a legitimate golden age moving forward. Andy, what do you think about that? You've been in this business a long time. You've seen the starts and fits. What do you think? Is this a golden age? Are we on the way to a golden age?
We're on the way is the right way to say it. My background is that I was a correspondent at NPR for many years, and joined Slate to work on a radio project, and then podcasting came along, and I thought, oh, finally, there's a part of the internet that I understand. So I jumped into that with Slate, with our talent there, and immediately it was like new vistas. The skies opened up and the heavens started to sing, and I was just thinking, oh my God, look at all these things you can do that you can't do in radio. First of all, I can do it from my desk. Second of all, there's no clock to worry about, and I'd been the clock had been my tyrant for 20 years. And so I just started trying everything I could. It was tremendously exciting, and it turned out to be one of the best things that Slate magazine, the online magazine founded by Microsoft in the 90s, has ever done. The connection with our audience has been phenomenal. They show up at live shows. They write in incredible numbers. They have become part of the club of our podcast. Everyone at Slate either has a podcast or wants one, and those that don't have one yet pin me up against the wall every time I walk through and say, when am I getting mine? So it is an exciting medium. However, I think that we are at, it's like radio was in the teens or 20s. We're just beginning to figure out what works, what advertising models work. We're all making it up as we go along. Luckily, I and I think everyone on this panel and the moderator have found a way to turn it into a business. But I think it's going to be a much bigger business. Because let me just make one more point and then I'll shut up. To me, podcasting is like the DVR. Once you start using a DVR, no one wants to go back to watching on someone else's schedule. But podcasting is better. You don't have to set a timer. You don't even have to know what programming is out there to record because people are doing it for you. Once people get into podcasting, they almost never stop. They listen to more and more of it. Audio on demand is the wave of the future for talk programming.
Rob, you look like you're holding that microphone with the purpose of saying something.
Oh, I think that's just habit because I'm a podcaster. No, but I mean, I agree with so much of what Andy said. I think what's really exciting about it from the audience perspective is that, you know, so much of podcasting encapsulates that engagement that people are, you know, really interested in. And it's a two-way conversation so much of the time. And it makes it something where, you know, people feel like, you know, there's this content that's being specifically created for them as opposed to content that's being, you know, broadcast. A lot of podcasting can really be on topics that people feel like is exactly the content that they're looking for.
Tom, you had a very, very successful radio career. And now you are a successful podcaster. What do you think about the age that we're in? And also, should podcasting be considered part of the overall audio medium? Has radio really sort of missed the boat by not embracing what we do as the digital on-demand part of an audio medium?
What's ironic is the company that is thought of as non-commercial, NPR, was so far ahead of the curve of everybody in the radio business. Radio stations now, because of their financial situation, many of these companies are over-leveraged, can't afford to spend any money on content, trying to ratchet down experimentation, whether it's on the music side or on the talk side. Meanwhile, NPR for years has figured out what people want to listen to on demand, and their content is incredible. It's a rich library, and so what's amazing to me is that radio missed the boat. It began in 1997 when I asked Mel Karmazin, why don't we have email addresses around here? And he said, you can't monetize the internet.
That's right. He thought it was a utility, as I recall. He
right.
said, this is a utility. It's like the gas company. So I have a question for you. Because Dan, you're one of the engines that makes podcasting go, and you were there from the early stages. First of all, I'd like to know why you were attracted to podcasting for your clients. Well, let's start it with that. What was it about podcasting? What was it about on demand that made you think this is an area that we should jump on? This is an area that we should specialize in, and this is an area that we should go to our advertisers with.
So my background was in talk radio, and doing ad sales at what is now iHeart at Clear Channel. And what I always focused on was personality endorsements. With personality endorsements, I found, you know, every advertiser conversation I'd have was the same. They'd say, you know, we'll give you some money. If it works, we'll spend more money. So I took them seriously when they told me that, the clients. And I found that when we did endorsements, the clients got better returns on their advertising investment. Eventually, I started seeing that through the internet, it was possible to have more diversity of programming than what we could do just through the presets in your car. And definitely saw an opportunity in that to take people that had a tribe or had influence where maybe you wouldn't be able to monetize it on the radio because it wouldn't be top 20, you know, or top 40 programming. You might not be one of the top presets, but you might have a national or international audience that could really drive a lot of product sales for one of our clients. So when we saw the advertising market starting to take root in the podcast world, when some of the bigger names came in, when Corolla came in, and we started seeing that advertisers were now getting in and able to drive results for their business, I was immediately very bullish about it. And so I saw Adam Carolla down the hall from my desk at the Clear Channel offices in LA promoting his podcast on a radio show. And I chased him to his car when he left, and I said, listen, I want to bring some of my clients to you because I think they could do really well in your show. And when we put that together and started running them there, I saw that the return on investment they were getting from that, particularly because I focus on companies that have some sort of disruptive technology, and when you marry that with an influencer whose audience likes disruptive technology because of the way that they're consuming media, it was very, very powerful, and it drove a lot of product sales. And consequently, we just have, you know, we got in front of it and did more and more and more, and we're, you know, first in from the ad agency standpoint, really exploiting that on behalf of our clients, because it's been a great way to drive sales for them.
So one of the reasons that I jumped into this was because I couldn't believe that anybody really hadn't, to the extent that I thought we could. There were very, you know, the business was very much mostly a mom and pop business with some with a few serious players sprinkled in between. You know, certainly NPR and the NPR radio stations, certainly Slate, certainly somebody like Adam Carolla, you, Tom, when you jumped in, and now Rob, you're, you know, seeing great success. One of the reasons that I thought it was so great was because I thought if a podcast has a million listeners and a radio network or a group of radio stations has a million listeners and a television station has or a television network has a million viewers, it seemed to me that our listeners were more valuable because they had to perform a positive act in order to consume the product, which made them, and this will be something that, Tom, you'll remember because, you know, of the old music radio days. These are the P1 listeners. These are the fans. You're promoting to the fan base, and now you've got social media with which to do it. It just seemed like such a no-brainer that, you know, we just started running around, and then all of a sudden, talent agent. I sit on the floor at the Laker games, and there's 8 seats between the scores table and the Laker bench. 4 of them are mine, and 4 of them are Ari Emanuel's. So I said, hey, let me tell you what we're getting ready to do. And then he says, that's interesting. Why don't you come over and talk to some of our people about it? And within 3 hours, United Talent had called. And within a week, we had, you know, been called by every major talent agency who's looking for a digital solution for their client base. Here's my question. This is to you, Tom, because you're a radio guy, you know. Even now that you're doing a podcast, you're still a radio guy. You may be pissed at radio, but you're still a radio guy.
Of course.
You know, I mean, why do you think radio doesn't take more of an active role in producing or publishing podcasts at the local level? And then move it into this business. I mean, I think CBS is sort of seeing the light, but I haven't seen anybody else really jump into it.
Well, I also think that for radio, taking a three-hour sports talk show with the same 12 people calling in all the time and putting it on demand, I don't think there's a lot of demand for that. You have to create new content, or you have to repurpose content in such a way that it's searchable, unique, and the kind of stuff that people are looking to listen to. I was talking to someone the other day who does a sports talk show, and he wants to have his show available on demand. I said, well, why do that? If you've got interviews with the commissioner of baseball or the NFL commissioner or Ray Rice or whoever you have interviews with, why wouldn't you just chop it down to the bare essentials of those interviews, make them searchable, and put them up as podcasts that way? And I don't think radio wants to, and this is really what's going on at radio stations with the budgets there, I don't think they want to spend the money to pay someone $40,000 a year to edit these shows, to babysit the talent when they come into the studio, to curate the content. They won't even spend that. And so all they do is they take the existing shows and post them online. And that's never going to get them anywhere. NPR works because they have content narrowed down, edited down, well-produced, sounds great every time. And radio stations are not willing to do that.
And they have the P1 listeners.
Well, exactly.
They
right.
really do. I mean, you know, NPR attracts a particular kind of audience that is fiercely loyal. You know, to them, I don't think they've seized the economic opportunity to the degree that they could. But, you know, I think they're moving more in that direction. Rob, you're in a genre right now which is kind of an interesting genre, because really what it is, it's sort of taking what's been commonplace in radio and television, the post-game show, you know, for sports, the sports post-game show. And now it's being applied to a TV series. Since every television program these days seems to be episodic, and it's really hard to keep them, at least for somebody of my age, it's very difficult to watch six different programs and go to one program and another and go, well, what happened to the Prince? Oh, that was that show. So post-game shows for popular television shows and even for movies have become quite the thing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a format that I've always loved. Growing up in New York, I listened to a ton of sports talk radio and WFAN in New York, and I found that, you know, with all these different shows that I was watching, you know, you'd have these sort of conversations about, you know, not just what just happened to recap, but what's going to happen next, and how do you talk to the audience, and everybody has their different theories about what they're going to do. And it's a really fun thing because, you know, you have people who already have a fandom for these different things that you're talking about, and then you're able to sort of, you know, move in and really capitalize on a fan base that may not have a community that's being served by the actual content.
Let me shoot this back to you, Dan, for a second. The growth, the initial support for podcasting has always come from the direct response advertiser, which takes maximum use of the host read and the connection with the host and so forth. But now there's a lot of companies, one in particular that I know fairly well, that are pushing very, very hard for brand advertising, for the major brands to come into podcasting the same way that they're on radio and the same way that they're on television. And we're seeing big brands. We're seeing the Geicos and the Walmarts and the Burger Kings now entering the podcasting market and becoming a regular part of overall buys. How do you feel about that when this is an area that you've had pretty much to yourself? What are you, you know, do you like the fact that the business is getting more attention, or is it tougher to get the kinds of deals you need on the inventory that's becoming less available?
I feel sad. So, you know, we don't do the direct response like the ShamWow stuff, but our portfolio of clients, as I mentioned, it's a lot of Silicon Valley stuff. It's dot-coms. It's disruptive companies, very metric-driven. And they're not measuring based on brand awareness. They're saying dollars in, dollars out, how many sales did I make? And so what I loved for a minute was the bonanza of being an early mover in that space where everybody's trying to keep the pirate ship afloat. The fans are fanatical. They've had to work very hard to get to this destination. The fewer buttons people have to push to listen to a podcast, and the wider the appeal is for the audience, and the less offensive it is to some people because there aren't necessarily individuals just giving their opinions about something, all of a sudden there's kind of a softening, and because there's a widening of the pool of listeners, then Madison Avenue starts to take notice. They start to, you know, standardize rating systems. They start to insert ads rather than make it all live reads that are baked in and live there forever. Some of the opportunities for performance-based marketers starts to dry up. So we have had situations where we had a really good show, had a good relationship with the talent, and then because they might be doing one show a week, where they're only doing two or three units in it, they sell out of inventory very quickly. When you're doing 24/7 content like on a radio station, you're not going to sell out of spots very often. In the podcast, because it is so finite, you sell out very quickly. So that has driven up demand, and things like Serial getting so much buzz has brought in so much brand attention that in some cases it is driving up the price. On the other hand, I am optimistic because as the audience gets bigger, there's still going to be these pockets of opinion-driven programming that's going to be, I believe, a new generation of talk radio. Performance marketers will always have a place there. Brands will always stay away. And I think it's going to continue to evolve. We just have to keep up with the changes.
You mentioned Serial. Who better to talk about the Serial effect than you, Andy?
Oh, well, I wish I had made Serial. Sadly, I had nothing to do with that. I just want to make one quick point about the advertising before I talk about the Serial effect. I've noticed an incredible sophistication in our audience about the advertising. They know why it's there. They know it's there to support the show they want and keep it free. And so they do things like they'll buy Harry's Razors or Blue Apron, which I think is one of yours, and then they'll write to us and tell us about it and say, see, I did this for you, and then they'll start tweeting about it, say, I got my Harry's Razor and it's great. They're like, they've become part of it. They are that invested in keeping us afloat that they know the transaction and they accept it, which I think is great. You've probably experienced that with other things too.
Absolutely.
The Serial effect. Well, the Serial, for those who don't know, I suspect you all
who
do,
doesn't know about Serial? Raise your hands.
Okay,
so you can just pass. I saw one hand being raised back there, and I don't believe it. Okay.
Well, Serial came in like a thunderbolt, although it came in during a year where already the hype and the popularity of podcasts was rising. But This American Life launched Serial, 12-part investigation into a high school murder from 1999, and it just became the buzz. There was a sketch about it on Saturday Night Live. It just overtook everything. And it actually, I don't think that it raised the audience level that much, but it raised the awareness, especially among advertisers and some people who had been on the fence. They'd heard about podcasting, hadn't really seen a compelling reason to figure out all these buttons and apps that you have to go through to get there, and finally they took the plunge. And it has been a terrific boon to the industry in all sorts of ways, but I think it's also raised expectations that we're in a boom, and I don't actually think that's true. Podcasting had a big hype boom when it started around 2004, 2005. Then everyone said it was dead. I would go to dinner parties and say what I do for a living, and people would look at me like, oh, you poor guy. Podcasting? And then it came up again. But if you looked at our growth chart of our audience, it never wavered. It went up, but not like this, but like this, steadily. People who came in stayed. They brought in a few new people. It kept going up. It's gone up more in the last year, and I'm pleased about that. I think that has a lot to do with Serial, but don't believe the hype. People who get into podcasting stay, and more are coming.
You know, the Serial's interesting. Fortune magazine did an article, and they interviewed me for it, and I didn't pick the headline. It certainly wasn't the one that I would have picked. But the headline was, Serial is small, Podcast One is building an empire. The point of it, I think the business of podcasting owes a debt to cereal that can never be repaid, because it really, really was something that brought consumer attention and water cooler chit-chat about a program that was viewed as so different because it was an audio program as opposed to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of programs, you know, that are, that use that format in television and in radio as well. But the thing about cereal, I mean, when I think about cereal, I think, well, would I, at this stage of the game, ever have taken a production team of about 10 people, given them a year to go out and produce a program that was going to have only a couple of advertisers in it, and would I have financed that? And the answer would have been no. But now I'm, you know, now I know there's a market there for that kind of stuff, and the company's bigger, and we've got more resources, even though we probably have the same resources we had when the company was smaller. And so that kind of programming, I think you're going to see a lot of people, a lot of companies moving in that direction, because clearly we know that the demand is there, we know that the premium rate is there, and since we're already, you know, by comparison to radio, practically commercial-free, I think you're going to see a lot of movement there. But they'll never, you know, Serial is the one who really set the bar, really set the bar. So, Tom, how different is your podcast than your radio show?
It's very different because it's really more of a miniature social network now. In radio, you spend 70% of the time chasing the people who don't really love you, the P2s and the P3s.
Who couldn't love you?
Oh, please.
Come on. Blow me up, Tom. Yeah.
But the P1 audiences were derided inside of radio stations. They called them things like contest whores and freaks. But I think in this world, the P1 is everything. Your partisans, the people who love you, they're the ones who are going to pay your bills. They're the ones who are going to show up at your events. They're the ones who are going to tweet about you. They're the ones who are going to tweet about Harry's. We have Harry's also, and we have the same effect. People buy the product for $15 and then post photos of razors and razor blades. You know, when I worked at a radio station, the listeners found commercials to be an intrusion. And in this world now, the listener does understand that the advertiser is an integral part of the show, because we can't do this. We don't have big companies behind us. We don't have private equity groups or hedge funds behind us. We don't have transmitters or satellite dishes. The listener understands that if they want their favorite program to go on, it's got to have advertising. I had it out today with someone on Facebook who was complaining that the app we just released had advertising in it. The app cost him absolutely $0.00, and he's complaining about the presence of advertising. So I took a shot at the guy, and I said, why don't you come down here and try to do this? And now it's this wild battle going on between people who think there should or shouldn't be advertising in an app. And I say, everybody doesn't like it. Tell you what, pay me $50 for the app, and we'll take the advertising out.
You know, there's a way around that. And I know, Rob, you've been successful at this. I mean, even though there's advertising in a podcast, I mean, you know, a big chunk of it comes in the pre-roll, which is before the program even starts. I don't want to say mid-roll because it's the name of a company I compete with. But there is a break in the middle of the show sometimes. Okay, it's a mid-roll. And you know, a lot of times, even when it's not a host-read spot, if the host just leads into the break by saying, look, we're going to take a short break, remember, these are the people who support this podcast and keep it free and with practically no commercial interruption. If you can get your host to say that with the engagement of the host, that's a tremendous selling proposition to an advertiser. And by virtue of the fact that we're seeing more and more, you know, I think that has been effective. Dan, you live there. I mean, what are the things that you try and get out of a podcast or audio on demand or any kind of digital audio? Because I know you buy it all, whether it's streaming and whether it's podcasting. You know, the digital world is exploding. What is it that you're looking for? What combinations do you think make it really a home run for your advertisers?
We look for influence. you know, when I worked in talk radio, we would talk about how talk radio was foreground listening, music radio was background listening. It's setting a mood. So if you're trying to get someone to go from A to B, whether that's buying a product or, you know, whatever kind of engagement, the engagement is deeper when you're listening to humans get talk, and specifically when they're giving an opinion about something. So when I'm trying to recruit people with influence, people with a tribe, to stand behind a product and say, let me tell you something, you've been listening to what I think about, you know, ABC for the last hour, now let me tell you about something I want you to go do. There's a tremendous amount of influence in that. So we very much gauge the success of a piece of programming that we sponsor by not just how many people did it reach or did it overlap with a theoretical target demographic. We really want to know, did it get somebody to go from here to there in a way that we believe in because we believe in our clients' products?
Let me say, I want to say one thing, then I want to open it up for questions from the audience. Let's get a little back and forth going on here. First of all, how many of you out there in the audience are in podcasting? Gee. Okay, then I want to say something to you. Well, you know, we're all in a business that is in its relative infancy in terms of its impact on the largest possible number of people, okay? And there's going to be growth coming from all kinds of different places. The one thing that I would implore you to do is think about the overall business as you go out there, promote, and produce your program. You know, CBS just came into the business. Now, we were talking with CBS about doing something with them for about 3 or 4 months, and we thought we were going to do it. And then all of a sudden, they brought in a digital guy, and he didn't like the idea. He thought, well, you know, we can do this ourselves. Well, digitally, they could. But when they decided that they were going to do it by themselves, I thought it was good anyway, because I thought CBS coming into the podcasting space was good for on-demand audio. And I think at this stage of our development, we sink or swim together. And I think we have to take a look at building an industry that is going to have the kind of credibility that is starting to be delivered by companies like Panoply, by companies like Podcast One, by companies like CBS, by companies like Midroll. They're starting to become bigger players that have the heft to be able to walk into advertising agencies and get people to actually pay attention. And having no negative effect on your ability to go out and subscription sell your programs and generate a financial model that is generated on cash. So that's the one thing that, you know, I mean, I don't know whether that's possible or not. I was in the radio business for 35 years, and for 35 years, we all cut each other up, you know, like we were in a knife fight. You know, if anybody else got the business and you didn't, you're screwed. But I would hope that in an industry that's in its infancy, that is becoming more and more mobile, that has the keys to consumers right here, where we can focus on content and not necessarily the way it's delivered, that's a real opportunity. So let's open it up to some questions for any of our panelists, because we've got about 5 minutes left, and then we're going to have to take a walk.
Question for Tom, because what you're doing is so conspicuous and we all see you working so hard at it. Since you launched, what has been your biggest surprise in the way this has worked out for you?
I would have to say my biggest surprise is the fact that it's really not like talk radio, what we're doing. You know, we began as the very same show we did on the radio, as if we had continued into the next day. But what it's evolved into now is, as I said earlier, like a social network. That we have all kinds of events where people pay big, big money to get in. We had a comedy show at the Laugh Factory that consisted of callers to our show. People paid $75 a ticket, three times the normal admission price, to get in and watch 15 call-in show callers performing comedy, most of whom had no experience in comedy. And it sold out the Laugh Factory on the Sunset Strip. I don't think in radio we ever would have done that.
Hi. Next question.
Yeah, hi. Earlier this morning in some of the panels, they talked about the big issue with podcasting is the lack of metrics. Can I ask the three content producers on the stage, how are you qualifying your audiences?
Well, we subscribe to Triton Digital for our streams, so we know the exact number of listeners, not only in terms of IP addresses, but in real time. I literally have a screen to my right as I work that shows me the real-time audience, and if we do a topic or talk to a guest that the audience is not digging, we say goodbye and we do something else. We can turn the show on a dime. In radio, if you wanted to know how you did on a given day, you'd have to wait 6 weeks to get the Arbitron numbers for that day. And now I know in real time if what we're doing is hitting the mark. We do not, in our case, we don't have metrics for our podcast because they're behind a paywall. So we don't worry about how many listeners the podcast have. We worry about the stream.
Let me tackle that a little bit, because when I got into this business, one of the things that I knew was we were going to have metrics for brand advertisers. Not so much for Dan, because Dan really, you know, he has a way of sourcing leads and sourcing acquisitions, cost per acquisitions, and so forth. So the size of the audience, though important, is secondary to how the commercial in the program pulls. But brand advertisers, that's a different story. So one of the things that I looked at was, you know, you can go out and get download numbers from a variety of sources, and they're generally pretty consistent, whether you get them from Akamai or Edgecast or any number of different CDNs. The overall downloads, you know, are pretty consistent. And then it seemed to me that the real issue was the filtration, okay? And there are a lot of really good companies out there who filter those downloads, you know, into listens or into uniques or into any number of other categories. Well, what's most important to a national advertiser is impressions. That's what they buy. So, you know, I went out to, as a matter of fact, a lot of you guys are sitting in the audience right now. Hey, Todd? And, you know, and we looked at different ways of filtering raw download numbers, and we just found that there was a wide variety of answers to the filtered download question in converting to impressions. And I personally felt very uncomfortable picking one over the other, saying this technology is the right technology. So we went back to what we were used to doing for a long time. We went to Edison Research, who's been measuring podcasting for since its inception, and we said, go out and we want some survey metrics and ask all the right questions. And then we thought, well, we're going to have something confirming. So we went out and looked into, you know, with companies like Abacast and Castfire, which are now part of Wide Orbit, and then started dart tagging and things of that sort so that we could track actual impressions at the time that the program was downloaded, you know, which doesn't give you everything, but it gives you a fairly strong base, and then used a 2 parts digital, 1 part survey metric and presented that to advertisers. It's been accepted, at least in the part of what we're doing, and now I think it's interesting to note that Nielsen and Wide Orbit and Agovino, who did I hire you from? Yeah, that's right, Triton. Anyway, there are a lot of companies who are in the research business, 4 of them that I can think of right now, that are going forward using surveys along with digital metrics. That's one way. I think this is going to evolve over time, but I think if you take a look at metrics that survey anything, their estimates, and what you've got to do is you've got to give an advertiser a straight story.
Yeah, if I can just add to that. I mean, sure. I don't think anyone would claim the podcast metrics are great right now. They leave a lot to be desired. What we really want is information about how long people are listening, when they're dumping out. And the problem is MP3 is a dumb format. It can't provide that information to us, so we depend on the players. And in our case, and I think for a lot of podcasters, the vast majority of our downloads come through Apple, and Apple does not share this information if they even collect it. I don't know if they do. But Apple is known for its secrecy. So I don't think we're going to be getting that. There are other solutions, as Norm mentions, that are being worked on by a variety of reputable companies. We're looking forward to the day when we can have more clarity for ourselves so we know what's working and what isn't, and for our advertisers.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. Let me just thank the panel. You know, let me thank Andy and Rob and Dan and Tom. And if somebody wants to thank me, they can.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. And thank you all for coming.